And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Happy Monday to you, Bonnie.
Thank you. Same to you.
Another week of our program.
Here we go.
Well, today we visit with Illinois Institute of Technology law professor and author Lori Andrews. We'll discuss her book, I Know Who You Are, and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. And Lori Andrews joins us from Chicago. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
Welcome, Professor. According to your book, which is pretty frightening, it would seem that most of us have or will have trouble with our online presence. How often would you say our personal information is used against us?
Well, you know, from teenagers on through the elderly, what you do online can be used against you. And I'd say pretty often. You've got 70% of employers saying they've actually rejected candidates based on their online profile. So that's a pretty hefty number.
Yes.
How do they get into their Facebook profiles unless they're friending them?
Well, one of the things is that there are now companies like Social Intelligence, Inc., which keeps people's social network profiles for the past 7 years. So think about that. If you were involved in underage drinking when you're 17, or you liked a violent video game, and then you decide when you're 18 to clean up your act and take down your Facebook page, those companies trade in that information until you're 24. So they use that information. They actually sell it to employees, sell information about what you've ever posted on Craigslist, what photos you have online. So some of it comes from these data aggregators that market information, and some comes from the fact that it's legal in most states for employers to ask for your social network password. Four states, including Illinois, have passed laws saying that it violates the law for employers to ask to see that private side of your Facebook page, but in other states, it's okay. And one-third of employers say they've rejected a candidate for having a drink in his or her hand, even an innocent wine glass in a wedding photo. So, unlike Vegas, what happens at Facebook doesn't stay in Facebook.
Tell us about the evolution of Facebook. First of all, the scope of Facebook and the evolution of Facebook and how it's become less private over time.
So that was one of the stunning things for me. There are now 1 billion members on Facebook, which would make it the third largest nation in the world after China and India. And yet other nations have laws, constitutions, certain requirements that the government has to follow. Not so Facebook. And so what happened when they first were formed, they had a paragraph, terms of service, a privacy policy that said, hey, anything you post, we'll only share with those people you designate as friends. Well, that changed pretty rapidly, and in 2009, they made your friends and their names public, and you couldn't do anything about that. What happened was there were people in the United States who were critics of the government of Iran, but had friends or relatives in Tehran, and when those friends and relatives' pictures and names became public, they were arrested, they were beat up, and so forth. So even something as simple as who you pal around with becomes something that could cause harm. And what fascinates me is that we have all sorts of protections for our offline selves, even things like freedom of association. There's a Supreme Court case that says that you don't have to disclose to the government who you associate with. And yet Facebook has violated that tenet with respect to our friends and what we're doing in their social network. And the problem is that our Constitution protects us against abuses by government, but not by private companies.
I was watching a documentary about Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg the other night, and what they seem to do is take two steps forward as far as opening up privacy issues. Then they apologize, but they only take one step back.
Yeah, they've many times he says, oops, we didn't mean to disclose that much. I mean, I must say Google, too. Google came out with a product called Google Buzz, and they figured, hey, we are going to compete with Facebook. And so what they did was they made social networks for people based on who you email most. And then one day when you went on Google, there was a little thing that said, hey, check out Google Buzz. And people clicked on it, and to their horror, what it did was create a social network profile for them with information about who they email most. Well, it could be your psychiatrist. It could be some stalker ex-boyfriend. It turned out like for one small businessman, he emailed most his clients, and so all their names became public, and the competition could pick it off. So Google learned from that, and now with Google Plus, they allow you to have more privacy control. But it's not just Facebook, and that's what amazed me. You may have people in your audience who think, hey, I am totally protected. I don't tweet. I don't post on Facebook. But if you ever use the Internet for anything, to make an airline ticket, to buy a book, and so forth, it turns out that data aggregators collect that information about what you do online, and they make certain decisions about you. And some of them are positive. I can get money off at a store that I routinely shop at online, or I might find out where my favorite band's playing. Information will be sent to me. But other times, that information can be used against you. And so we have companies like Axiom, which refers to itself as the biggest company you've never heard of. And for 96% of Americans, it has 1,500 bits of data, including what prescription drugs you've used, what various of your habits are. And here are the surprising ways it can be used against you. So I would know not to put up a drunken hot tub photo of myself, on my Facebook page. But I may not know that if I send my sister a private email over Gmail saying, I'm thinking of getting a divorce, or if I go do a Google search for old guitars and then I go to a credit card page, I'll actually get a less good credit card, a lower limit, not because of anything I've done, but because divorcing people as a whole and people in garage rock bands as a whole tend not to pay off their credit cards. So it's shocking.
Are these aggregators not subject to any laws at all?
No, they aren't, pretty much. They think about it. For the credit bureaus, we actually have something, a federal law called the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And so if they say, hey, Bonnie doesn't have good credit, Joe doesn't have good credit, Lori doesn't have good credit, they can be held accountable if that's untrue. And you're required, they're required to notify you if you're turned down for a credit card. Oh, that's because, it was said that you didn't pay off your, other credit card bill. And you can correct the information. You can know when things are happening. But you can lose a job or not get it or lose credit or, have all these horrible things happen to you based on what data aggregators do, and there's no such law protecting you. Mm. They don't have to tell you. They don't have to correct it.
Lori Andrews, I was amazed in the book to learn that if an institution or business issues you a laptop, that they can activate remotely website cameras on that laptop at any time. Of course, it may be sitting on your dresser in the bedroom.
Absolutely. And in Pennsylvania, a wealthy high school decided to give free laptops to all their students. And they didn't tell the students or the parents that that camera, as you say, could be activated from the school. And it was only supposed to be activated if someone stole the laptop, so you get a picture of the thief. But what happened was that the computer department at the school started routinely activating the cameras and took tens of thousands of pictures of students and even faculty members in their homes. And you're right. You have them open. These high school students had them open their bedroom. They're coming in and out of the shower. They're sleeping. And it only came to light when a student was called into the assistant principal's office, and she said to him, we have evidence you were using illegal drugs. And she showed him a picture of himself in his bedroom, and he was shocked. And he looked at what was in his hand, and he said, those are Mike and Ike candies, the kind you get when you go to the movie theater that are, vaguely oval-shaped like pills. So here, and it turned out the FBI actually said, there was no crime committed videotaping people in their homes or taking pictures of them through the camera. It's a good lesson for your listeners because we're all carrying miniature surveillance devices if we have a cell phone. And it's important to know when we download apps what exactly they do. Some of the apps, by downloading them, you're actually agreeing that your mic can be remotely activated by data aggregators. And so what happens is if some marketing company wants to know whether I eat at home alone or out in restaurants or have sex with some of the opposite sex or the same sex, my mic of my phone can be activated through some of the various apps that are downloaded. So we need to take real care with all those cool toys we buy, all those great digital products, to see that we aren't unwittingly opening up our lives to third parties we don't want to know about.
I want to ask you about some of those apps. We're speaking with Laurie Andrews. She's a law professor and author. Her latest book is I Know Who You Are, I Saw What You Did. And it's today's topical currents. We're going to take a short break. We'll take some calls and emails when we return.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying. At facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return 20 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with author Laurie Andrews. Her book is I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did. Was there a film in the mid-60s with a similar name, Laurie?
It does. Play off of a film noir because it is a way in which just like in those old black and white kind of detective movies, smoky rooms, people are sort of checking into your private life like those old private detectives did.
So tell us what kind of apps you're referring to when you say when we sign that agree, because some of those consent forms are so long, and who's going to read them all? So you just say, I accept. What kind of apps are we downloading where they can actually access our mic?
First on the downloading without reading, I mean, that's so common, especially, who is going to read a 25-page terms of service on your little cell phone?
Right.
And it turns out one company actually has a joke put on their terms of service: by clicking here, you give us your immortal soul. And it turned out 88% of people clicked and gave up their immortal soul. They weren't reading it. There's an app called Into Now, which the purpose of which is to, if I'm watching television, be able to use my mic to figure out what show I'm watching. I'm a lawyer in Chicago, so maybe I'd watch The Good Wife, a show about a lawyer in Chicago. And then it would put me in chat rooms with other people watching the same show or try to sell me things related to the show. But that allows remote activation of the mic, which can be done for other reasons. It turns out the Apple Store and other of the online purveyors aren't very clear in their little descriptions about exactly what the apps do. So the Federal Trade Commission did a study, and it found that many of the apps for children, and who knew there were hundreds of apps for 0 to 2-year-olds, let alone 10-year-olds and 13-year-olds, that they didn't disclose that they were keeping GPS tracking information on you, and then, could market that information. So think about it. Angry Birds, a lot of people play Angry Birds. Why does it need to know my GPS location and have that as something it could sell? There was a Supreme Court case last year where the cops put a GPS tracking mechanism on the bottom of a suspect's car and collected data for 20-some days about every place he went. And the Supreme Court said 9-0, that was an invasion of privacy. It violated the Fourth Amendment. And Justice Sotomayor in particular said, look at all the things I can learn about a person from their GPS information. I could learn whether they go to a church, a synagogue, a mosque. I could learn whether they go to an AIDS clinic, an abortion clinic, are meeting with the rival of their current boss. So even something simple, where you've been, which is routinely collected by apps, could be used, you know, against you. It could be used, I mean, it already has been used in terms of, you know, people who aren't necessarily, you know, at their workplace during the whole day and so forth, or, you know, stalkers have used it. You know, one woman was purportedly raped by someone who had, in fact, sexually abused her in the past, even though she'd moved to several states, but, you know, by using a service that then discloses people's location information.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, we're speaking with law professor and author Lori Andrews about her book, I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did. You can give us a call at 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. And also you can email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Lori, how about on Facebook, what settings should people select for the most privacy?
Well, I mean, you want to make sure that you're controlling who your, you know, photos are going to, you know, but as I've said, it it isn't as protective as you would think. You end up with, you know, third parties like employers being able to ask you for your password. I mean, but there are certain things you can do with searching in incognito mode. If you really, really want to get intense about it, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has some helpful tips on the website about how to use various free anonymizers because, you know, it turns out that, you know, what you search for can get you into trouble, can be used against you. I also write mystery books, so imagine my searches. I invented a date rape drug in one. I blew up the White House in another. So we've had already police building entire cases based on Google searches. So heaven forbid your, you know, spouse should disappear after you've, you know, looked up the depth of a nearby lake. And so I think part of what troubles me is that assumptions are being made about people that may not be true. So employers who even look at your public Facebook page, because you may not think to make it private, the section that says what organizations you like. Most people have that public. Well, 5 million Americans like Facebook pages about health. So I might like the American Cancer Society. And maybe I'll like it because I think they're a good nonprofit, or I enjoy some, you know, walk or something, or I had a friend as a child who had cancer. Well, an employer can look at that, think it relates to me, and not hire me because they think I might be at risk of cancer and would cost them a lot of money. So we're seeing things that aren't even particularly valid. I mean, I'm seeing middle schoolers being charged with being gang members because they are wearing gang colors or making gang signs in their MySpace or Facebook photos. I can perfectly see a middle schooler who's being bullied trying to appear tough and doing a gang sign in a photo, and yet it not mean he's a gang member. And when I looked up the Los Angeles Police Department's definition of what's a gang color, plaid, think any hipster, you know. And so this information can be, you know, used in ways that isn't even truthful, and it's made worse by Mark Zuckerberg and others at Facebook who say, oh, your Facebook is your authentic self. So then judges say, oh, well, I agree. And so in one case where a woman was harmed in the workplace, she needed 4 spinal surgeries, had pins put in her neck, and she sued. The judge actually said, you're smiling in your Facebook photo. You can't have been that hurt.
It's just amazing that judges and police are getting away with this. What federal agencies are using our online data, and do they have to obtain warrants to access our information?
That's such an important point, because I'm seeing manuals for the Internal Revenue Service, for the immigration folks. Virtually every area of government now uses social network information, and it's not done through the warrant process. I love this quote from security analyst Richard Power. He says, you know, I mean, think about what we post, you know, what a billion people give to Facebook. I mean, you might have your, you know, political beliefs, your sexual preference, and so forth. And what he says is, if the government tried to get that information, it would take money, it would take lawyers, it might even take guns, you know, if they just asked you directly. But what happens is, all that information, when the government asks Google for information about what we've sent on Gmails, what we've searched for, 93% of the time, Google turns it over. So we're not very well protected. And and you've raised such a huge point, because if cops, you know, tried to tap my phone, they'd need a warrant. If they tried to come in my house, or if my boss tried to come in my house and find out about me without my permission, he'd be guilty of trespass. And I think we just have got to find a way to protect our online self as much as our offline self.
Well, we'll get to your social network constitution components in a few moments, Lori Andrews. But let's take a call or two. We've got Jack. Jack's in Palm Beach Gardens. Hi there.
Hi. I just wanted to tell something that happened in the last couple of days that absolutely shocked me. I received an email from a friend of mine that I hadn't talked to in over a year, who's from China. And so I get the email, and I replied back. And then the next day, Facebook sends me an email saying, do you know this person? Well, the person has a very unusual Chinese name, you know, and not an American name. And they said, do you want to friend them? Mm. Well, the email was sent through Google. And so Facebook must be mining Google's emails.
It's a fascinating point. And there are a couple of things, you know, that happen. There are actually other websites that you might go to that put tracking mechanisms, cookies, on your computer. So I write a lot of books. I've written 14 books. I love dictionary.com. I look up words all the time. Until I started writing this book about internet privacy, I had no idea they put 233 tracking mechanisms, 233 cookies on my computer. So it might even be a third party. Sometimes if you haven't signed out completely of Facebook, they will track what you do elsewhere. And I was shocked in the last presidential campaign that both Obama and Romney were putting cookies on people's computers in order to see what sort of websites they went to. Did they go to religious ones? Did they go to pornographic ones? Did they go to both? And then tailoring the message to them. It sounds like I'm making this up. All this is based on, you know, detailed studies done by MIT or the Pew Center on Society and the Internet, you know, but it's unbelievable to me how when consumers have sued and said, hey, you know, it violates my privacy to have a cookie put on my computer and track me, the courts have actually taken a wrong turn, and they've said as long as one party gives consent, and in that case, if dictionary.com gives consent, then third parties can put cookies on my computer without asking me. I absolutely think they should have to ask the person whose personal information is being marketed.
Right. I'm pretty shocked about the email when you say about the Gmail. Isn't our email private?
No. So
no.
Google has about 60 different services they own, you know, YouTube and Gmail and all of, you know, and various others, the search engine and Google Plus. And about a year ago, they made a decision they were going to combine information across platforms. So that could be, you know, bad. I mean, I could be, you know, watching a YouTube video with my son after having, you know, looked up on Google some side effect of a medication or information about a disease, and an ad will pop up on YouTube for that condition, which could, you know, scare my son that something's, you know, wrong with me or whatever. So they do use information, and, you know, and there's some, in addition to the financial issues of you know, potentially not, you know, being found worthy of a credit card, and that there are some psychological ones. So teenage girls who might once look up, you know, a diet something through Google, well, then every website they go to, if they're looking at movie times, you know, they'll see these ads, feeling fat, you know, it makes you feel worse about yourself. And in fact, Google admitted that when young people were on chat rooms where a young person would say, I'm thinking of committing suicide using X chemical, ads would actually appear saying, you know, dial 1-800 now, 2-for-1, this chemical. You know, so a lot of people say, hey, I love it that it's tailored to me. It knows I'm going to take a trip to, you know, Florida, and then it, you know, sends me information about what's happening in South Florida. You know, but it is at a cost. One man, you know, went on a honeymoon. He had great credit. He'd paid off his credit card bills every month. He had a credit limit of $10,000. When he got back, American Express had written to him and said, we've lowered your credit limit to $3,000, not because of anything you've done, because you've shopped at places where other people tend to not be as likely to pay off their credit card. So what happened to our right to being treated as individuals? We're, you know, really, you know, losing it with this, with the algorithms determining, based on a whole bunch of data, what is given to us. You know, so big thing that I've learned since writing the book is that life insurance companies are now turning to social networks. And a consulting group actually advised life insurance companies to stop doing the blood and urine test to see if people merit life insurance and instead look at their social network page. And these are some of the things they say should be used against you. Avid reader. I'm hoping your audience is all avid readers.
Why would that be used against somebody?
I guess they think, you know,
that you're sedentary.
You're sedentary. They don't ask me if I'm reading on a treadmill or if I'm, or if the next guy is sitting around playing video games or eating at McDonald's, you know, while I'm just, you know, reading. And then commute to work. I guess that's supposed to be more stressful, more likely to have accidents. And eat fast food. And then another one, have friends who are skydivers. They actually say behavior is contagious. Well, you know, I have a lot of interesting, you know, friends. I have forensic buddies, people in, you know, dangerous lines of work and so forth. It's the fun of, you know, having a diverse life and also of, you know, of writing and having people to run things by and so forth. I also buy Harley Davidson shirts for a friend who loves them. I don't ride a motorcycle, but
you must be a weirdo then.
You know, I must. You know, I'm about to die young. You know, and so I'd probably have trouble getting life insurance with this idea that I'm friends with risky people.
We're speaking with law professor and author Lori Andrews of Illinois Institute of Technology. And we're talking about her book, I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. Lori, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
Oh, socialnetworkconstitution.com, or you can do Lori Andrews, LoriAndrews.com. I'd love people's help at, you know, sort of figuring out what to do. There are many politicians who are interested in changing this. I have some advice about change in the book, but, you know, since many people don't realize this is going on, that they may have lost a job because of something that was found on a Google search that doesn't even apply to them, politicians aren't, you know, having their constituents, you know, write to them about some of these problems. I mean, one guy can't get a job because his dad, who had the same name, was arrested, never convicted, when he was about the age of the man is now. So, you know, employers Google him, get a mugshot of the guy's dad, and just don't go any further.
Let's take another caller. This is Juan in Hollywood. Hey, Juan.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. It's a great topic. The question that I have is this: what can we do now to protect ourselves? Because it affects everybody from, you know, all levels of life, even politicians, I'm sure, too, would love to know. But I just wanted to know, what can we do now, you know, yes, we can try to change the future, but what can we do now to protect ourselves?
Great question.
Great. Yeah. So, you know, limit who information is distributed to, and you can do a lot of things with that. You can clean cookies off your computer. You can look at Google Dashboard to see, you know, who, what organizations, what entities might be.
That's Google Dashboard?
Yeah, like what their presumptions are about you. And also, a big thing would be to turn off locator information. You know, it turns out that most smartphones, when you take a photo, the digital file has the location in which it has been taken. And, you know, some people discovered to their dismay, they then post that picture of their fancy new engagement ring and, or, you know, some new piece of art they have for their house, and they're robbed because of the digital photo file actually includes the location. So a lot of it is, you know, just, you know, upgrading your privacy settings on the apps, on the phone, you know, on your computer. Don't accept search engine cookies, you know, but we need to move it to where it's
we can't go back to the Stone Age. But is it a good idea to not post any personal pictures online?
It really depends. It think of Ashley Payne. So she's a school teacher in her 20s. She had not friended any students or any parents of students. She went to Ireland and Italy on vacation in the summer, posted 700 photos, like people that age do, on her Facebook page. A handful of them showed her with a beer in her hand. She was at the Guinness factory on tour. They're perfectly innocent photos. She lost her job as a result. So there are dangers. I would worry about things that, that link your data together. So there was an app called, you know, Girls Around Me, and, you know, guys in bars could then, based on, you know, which girls were checking in on Foursquare, see pictures of them and how close they were to the man. And also it linked you into other information about them, what they posted on their Facebook pages and so forth. So, you may not be aware that there are these ways in which information from one platform is used by another, and you may not want strangers in bars to know, a lot of things about you from your Facebook page. You know, I think that in reality, all of us, there are huge benefits to social networks. There was one called Patients Like Me, where, you know, people with particular health problems who might have a rare disease or might be separated by distance in rural areas where they didn't know other people with it, could, you know, communicate with each other, could post things about their health and learn, you know, what they could do to avoid the side effects of medications. And then Nielsen, a big data aggregator, posed as a patient on it and sent bots around to collect people's information. And that benefit of that social network was indeed lost. So I think, you know, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Patients Like Me, all these things have great benefits, and we've just got to be careful at the moment until we get ourselves to the point where our privacy is protected online.
Well, are there movements afoot to ensure that is anybody drawing lines as to what should and shouldn't be legal?
You know, well, courts aren't doing a good job. I mean, there was a New Jersey judge who said, oh, your emails, they just think of them like a postcard. Just assume everybody, you know, would be allowed to read them. And, you know, that's just, you know, an unfair attitude, because more and more you can't apply for a job except over email. Right now, the big hospital that provides my health care in Chicago, you have to make your appointments online. And all this is classic private information that's been protected in our society for, you know, years. So the movements are people like Congressman Ed Markey from Florida or Joe Barton from Texas are starting to take this on. State legislatures are starting to take this this on, with four states now saying your employer can't ask for your social network password. Florida, there have been some court cases. One of them, a woman used a tracking device on the computer to spy on her husband in the course of a divorce, and the Florida courts said, hey, that violates the state wiretap statute. So some states, including Florida, California, are beginning to look to state laws, since the federal laws, which were supposedly there to protect us, courts have misinterpreted. So I'm hopeful. I mean, it turns out that every technology that has been in use for the past 125 years initially said, people said, oh, privacy's dead. I was amused to find that in the late 1800s, when the portable camera was developed, newspaper editorials called it the Kodak fiend. And they said it's horrible because it can invade your privacy. You used to have to be able to, go to a photo studio. You could control your appearance. And now pictures could be taken of you anywhere, sort of like tagging on Facebook. And so initially it seemed like privacy was dead. But what happened was, states passed statutes that said you control your image, you can sue someone for violating your privacy, and I think we'll see the same thing here ultimately.
We're speaking with law professor and author Laurie Andrews. Her latest book is I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. Going to take another short break. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Monday afternoon. And we resume our conversation with Laurie Andrews and her book, I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did. Let's take another caller. This is Michael in Delray. Hello.
Yeah, hi. This is Michael calling from Delray Beach. And I wanted to bring up the fact that AOL, even prior to 9/11, is always tracked everything and kept every keystroke. A prime example was a kid, Johnny Walker Lind, who was fought for the Taliban, was caught after 9/11 in Afghanistan. He'd been with Bin Laden for 2 years, and also the news was reading all his emails and chat room conversations and everything as if it was real time, and he hadn't had a computer for a couple of years. So I think people need to look about AOL as well.
Hmm. Laurie?
Yeah, I mean, no matter what service you use, there have been issues. So AOL did something a few years ago, which they decided to release all the searches people made for the past few months, thousands and thousands of its users, and make them public. And they said, oh, we're not doing anything, problematic because we don't include the person's name. Well, think about everything you've searched for. You interview people all the time. You could, be looking for things with respect to crimes and so forth. And so they released it, and they didn't realize that you don't need someone's name anymore to be able to, figure out who they are based on the Internet. So the New York Times, in about a millisecond, took the fact that one woman had looked for gardeners in a small area of Georgia. She'd looked up other people with her last name on a genealogical database, and they were able to just call her up. And that meant that the other searches that she'd done for various health conditions could be linked to her and used against her. So even AOL isn't above the fray. I want to circle around and talk a little bit about employment, because a lot of people are having a hard time there, to say there is some protection. So if you're hired because of something you've said on a social network page, you have three places you can look for protection. So the Pittsburgh Pirates fired one of their mascots, one of the guys who ran in the pierogi races, because of something he'd said about management, he'd posted. He was able to get reinstated because, there was a handbook that had a particular process that wasn't followed. So employees can look to the employee handbook to see the extent to which their social network information is protected. There can also be state laws like the one I mentioned in Florida dealing with wiretapping, or there might be a state constitution that gives you higher privacy rights. And then there are federal laws. It turns out if you are posting negative things about your workplace, but in an attempt to have concerted action to change it, like if you think it's unsafe or, you know, your rights are being violated in some way, then you know, you can be, protected and reinstated in your job. So there are some things. There's also been a big change with respect to students. A lot of students got suspended, kicked out of school for criticizing a class or a teacher or the principal. And it turned out that in a series of cases just over the past year that courts have held that you don't have to check your First Amendment rights, your right to free speech, at the door when you go into a school. You have a right to post certain things on social networks. But I don't know if you read about a Texas school recently, just last week, that expelled a student because she refused to wear a GPS tracking device.
Right.
I don't know, we're looking to all this data as a way to solve all our problems. And the school said, well, you know, this is because, you know, we want to know who's in the stairwell and who's late for class and things like that. But, you know, imagine, you know, some perfectly innocent person could be thought of as being part of a gang or a group of bullies just because you happen to be walking down the same hallway at school at the same time. And, it is sort of science fiction, come to life. Google makes $36 billion a year, 96% of its income. Yes, it provides us free services, but that 96% of its income comes from trading in, commercializing our private information.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about your social network constitution and what you hope to accomplish with it. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so why not have the same rights online as offline, like a freedom of expression, the right to privacy? There are all sorts of freedom from discrimination, all sorts of things that we take for granted and are protected in the real world that aren't yet protected online. And I think if more people can get behind something like that, we can use a social network constitution for several purposes. We can, you know, get it before judges so that they at least have to think about people's privacy when they make these rulings about whether email should be thought of it like a postcard or not. We can use it as a way to say, hey, I'm buying a new app. Does it cause a problem in one of these areas? Will it, invade my privacy by constantly providing location in ways that I might not want it to? It's a way to sit down with state and federal legislators and say, okay, here's a starting point. If it's good enough for, you know, the offline world, why not for the online world? Because if anything, the risks to privacy on the online world are worse in that if, you know, someone invades your privacy by posting something, a photo of you or something else in a compromising position, it never goes away. So, those are some of the issues to think about.
Does any software exist that can protect us?
Not yet, no. And so, but I'm hoping. So as I talk to your audience, I want those, you know, smart teens and 20-somethings to be the Mark Zuckerberg of the future by offering us some privacy-protective technologies as opposed to privacy-invading ones. I mean, think about it. Think about how much you pay for your cell phone use every month. You would expect that, you know, your privacy would be protected. People say, well, Facebook is free. But Facebook only makes $4 per person per year. So I'd be willing to pay $5 or $10 to have a private alternative. I'm certainly paying more than that to be able to speak to people on the phone. So let's encourage all your, you know, young tech-savvy listeners to be thinking of privacy protective technologies. One that's being experimented with by researchers in Israel is it's sort of fun. It's it sends back a bunch of false information about you so that the data aggregators can't say, you're a person of that age and, you read, so you shouldn't get life insurance. So I expect that, the technologies could lead us in a better direction, but we need laws as well.
We have an emailer, Frank. He says, what will the government do if all citizens begin to encrypt all their email? Or what will they do when smartphone programmers create voice encryption software? Make encryption illegal?
Well, they have tried that at various levels, but there are cases that say encryption is protected by the First Amendment. So, if you go back to the very beginning, and it's the 225th anniversary of the U.S. Constitution, those people who drafted it really have thought all these things through. And one of the important things to them, if you're going to have a democratic society, is that you have to be able to have certain anonymity. So encryption, I think, would be protected.
Okay. Lori Andrews, it's been a very interesting hour. She's a law professor and author, and we've been discussing her book, I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. Thank you very much, Lori.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you.
And that wraps up our Monday edition. Our apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our program was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Of course, we have free audio archives and downloads of past topical currents at our website, WLRN.org. There's more information about authors, books, programs, staff, and more at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is Cosmic. We'll speak with paleontologist Neil Shubin about the universe within, discovering the common history of rocks, planets, and people. We are but stardust. And to the calendar, on this day in 1954, 59 years ago, just retired baseball star Joe DiMaggio marries Hollywood's Marilyn Monroe at San Francisco City Hall. It lasted 9 months. And on this day in 1968, 45 years ago, the NFL's Green Bay Packers beat the AFL's Oakland Raiders 34-14 at the Orange Bowl in what would the next year be named the Super Bowl. That game, TV coverage was blacked out in the Miami area. One more while we turn the pages of Delta of Venus and House of Incest. On this day in 1977, 36 years ago, the death of writer Anais Nin. Though born in France, her parents were Cuban. She was 73 and romantically linked with writer Henry Miller, of course, the first husband of Marilyn Monroe. Tie it all together. And we leave with a thought from Nin, best known for her journals. Quote, love never dies a natural death. It dies because we don't know how to replenish its source. This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 91.